She stands with a stenographic tape in her hand. She reads in a flat voice, "Question by Mr. Molto. Did Rusty Savage ever tell you that he had killed Carolyn Polhemus?" Laren holds up a hand so that the court reporter can resume her seat and prepare to take down the response. Then the judge nods to the witness. "The answer to the question," says Robinson in his measured way, "is no. Mr. Savage never told me anything like that." The courtroom ruffles in a fashion that it has not to date, with an air of release. The jurors nod. The schoolteacher smiles at me. Molto will never give up. "Did you ever speak in any way about the subject of murdering Ms. Polhemus?" "Objection to that question and to all further questions concerning communication between Mr. Savage and the doctor." "The objection is sustained. The objection is taken as a limiting notion and is granted. Any further inquiry being prohibited or irrelevant to these proceedings, I intend to terminate this examination. Dr. Robinson, you are excused."
"Your Honor!"
shouts Molto. But Nico instantly has him by the arm. He leads Tommy away from the podium as they exchange words. Nico nods to humor him, but he seems to have a firmness, a resolve that does not partake of Tommy's outrage. The judge looks only at Nico. "Do I take it, Mr. Delay Guardia, that the state rests?" Nico answers, "Yes, Judge. On behalf of the people of Kendall County, the state rests." Laren will dismiss the jury now for the weekend and hear the motion for a directed verdict. He turns to them. "Ladies and gentlemen, I would ordinarily ask you to leave the courtroom at this point in time, but I am not going to do that. Your service in this case is now over." I do not understand these words at first, but when I feel Jamie Kemp's arms around me, then Stern's, I know what has occurred. My trial is over. The judge has gone on speaking. He tells the jurors that they may stay if they please. I am weeping. I put my head down on the table for a moment. I am sobbing. But I lift my head to listen as Laren Little sets me free. He is addressing the jury. "I have reflected on this case at length over the last 24 hours. At this time, normally, a defense lawyer makes a motion for the judgment of acquittal, and most often a judge decides to let the case proceed. Usually there is enough evidence so that a reasonable jury might find a defendant guilty. I think it's fair to say that there ought to be. No man ought to be brought to trial without sufficient evidence that some fair people might conclude beyond a reasonable doubt that he is guilty. I think justice requires that. And I think that in this case justice has not been done. I understand the prosecutors have suspicions. Before yesterday I might even have said that there were reasonable grounds for suspicion. Now I'm not so sure of that. But I cannot let you deliberate on evidence like this, which is so clearly inadequate. It would be unfair to you, and most importantly, to Mr. Savage. No person should be held on trial on evidence such as this. I have no doubt that your verdict would be a ringing not guilty. But Mr. Savage should not have to live with this specter a moment longer. There is no proof of motive here. No concrete evidence that there was even an intimate relationship. There is no effective proof, so far as I am concerned, after yesterday, to give any reasonable person grounds to believe that Mr. Savage even had carnal relations with Ms. Polhemus on the night of her death. And as we have just seen, there is not a shred of direct proof that he murdered Ms. Polhemus. Perhaps he was there that night. The state might be entitled to that inference. If the prosecutors had ever found that glass, I might be more confident. But under all the circumstances, I cannot let the case proceed." "Your Honor," Nico is on his feet, "Mr. Della Guardia, I understand you are despairing at this time, but I am speaking, and I would like you to hear me out. Your Honor, I have just a few words to say about Mr. Molto. Judge, I want to move to dismiss." Laren starts. Actually draws back. In the courtroom, there is a larger stir. and then the serial sound of people moving. I know without looking back that the reporters are fleeing for their phones. The TV guys will have to get their camera vans down here. Nobody was planning for the shit to hit the fan at this point. Laren bangs his gavel and demands order. Then he opens his large hand to indicate that Nico may proceed.
Judge, I just wanted to say a couple of things. First, it seems like a lot of people have started to think that this case is some kind of frame-up or sham. I deny that. I want to deny that. On behalf of all members of the prosecution, I think we were right to bring this case.
You had a motion, Mr. Delay Guardia?
Yes, Judge. I hoped, when I came to court this morning, that you would let the case go to the jury. Some judges would, I think. I think that's the right thing. But some judges probably wouldn't. And since you've apparently made up your mind,
I certainly have.
For Mr. Savage's sake, I don't think there should be any question about whether this was a proper legal decision on your part or not. I disagree with you. We do disagree. But I don't think it's fair to pretend that I think you're outside the law. And I certainly don't want anyone thinking I'm looking for excuses.
Nico turns, if only barely, to look over his shoulder in the direction of Stern.
So, for those reasons, I would like to accept your judgment and move to dismiss the case.
That motion is allowed.
Laren stands. Mr. Savage, you are discharged. I cannot tell you how sorry I am that any of this has taken place. Not even the pleasure of seeing you free can make up for this disgrace to the cause of justice. I wish you Godspeed.
He bangs his gavel. Case dismissed, he says, and leaves.
Chapter 36. Turmoil. My wife, my lawyers, reporters, onlookers, I do not know. They all wish to touch me. Barbara is the first. The feeling of her arms around me so firmly, her breasts girdled against me, her pelvis squeezed against mine is astonishingly stimulating. Perhaps this is the first sign of the regeneration of my life.
I'm so glad, she kisses me. I'm so glad for you, Rusty.
She turns from me and hugs Stern. Today I elect to make my once-only exit through the heating plant. I do not wish to face the press's disordered melee. I gather Barbara, Stern, and Kemp toward the end of the lobby, and then we drop out of sight. But, of course, there is no escaping. Another gaggle is waiting when we reach Stern's building. We make our way upstairs with little comment. From somewhere, a luncheon has appeared in the conference room, but there is no opportunity to eat. The phones ring, and the secretaries soon report that the reception room is a mob scene, with reporters spilling out into the halls. The hungry monster must be fed. I cannot deny Stern this moment. He deserves it. And the consequences of this kind of success in a celebrated case, in terms of both economics and professional stature, will enlarge Stern's career for years to come. He is now a lawyer of national standing. And so, after half a corned beef sandwich, we all descend to the lobby of the building to again confront the jostling, shouting crowd of reporters, the microphones, the recorders, the brilliant lights that rise up around me like a dozen new suns. Stern speaks first, then me. I don't think that anybody under these circumstances can say anything adequate, especially in a short period of time. I am very relieved that this is over. I will never fully understand how it happened in the first place. I am grateful that I was represented by the best lawyer on the face of the earth. I dodge the questions about Delaguardia. I am still not settled in my own mind. There is already a large part of me that is content with the idea that he was merely doing his job. No one asks about Laren, and I do not mention his name. In spite of my gratitude, I doubt that after last night, I could bring myself to praise him. Back upstairs, there is now champagne, the same vintage as Kemp popped the night before. Was Stern preparing for victory, or does he always keep a case on ice? There are still many visitors in the offices. I stand among them with Kemp and Stern and drink toasts to Sandy. Clara is here, Sandy's wife. Mac arrives. She weeps as she embraces me in her chair. "I never had any doubt," she says. Barbara finds me to say that she is going to leave. She has some hope that Nat's return can be advanced one day. Perhaps the camp director can arrange a seat on the DC-3 that flies back and forth from Skagen. This will require many phone calls. I see her out through the lobby. She embraces me again. "I am so relieved," she says. "So, so glad it turned out this way." But something between us is impenetrably sad. I cannot right now fully imagine Barbara's inner states, but I think that even in this moment of rapturous gratefulness and relief, she recognizes that something suspended still remains. In the aftermath of all of this, to go beyond our old troubles will require a treacherous journey across nearly unspannable chasms to grace and forgiveness. In Stern's offices, people keep arriving. A number of cops are here, lawyers around town who have come to congratulate Sandy and me. I feel ill at ease among the many outsiders, so few of whom I know. And my initial euphoria is long past, given way to a suppressed melancholy. At first, I believe I am exhausted and full of pity for myself, but eventually I recognize that my disturbance seems to arise, like black oil percolating from the earth, from something more particular, an idea that seems to demand time for contemplation, and quietly as I can, I leave. I do not say that I am going. I slip out with the excuse that I am finding the head. Then I drift out of the building. It is late afternoon. The shadows are longer, and off the river a breeze is up that is rich and full of summer. The night editions of the papers are on the stands. The Tribune head is half a page, "Judge Frees Savage," and the kicker calls prosecution a disgrace. I pay my quarter. Decrying a disgrace to the cause of justice, Kendall County Superior Court Judge Laren Little today dismissed murder charges against Rojat K. Savage, former chief deputy in the Kendall County Prosecuting Attorney's Office, ending Savage's 8-day-old trial. Judge Little sharply criticized the case presented by the Kendall County Prosecuting Attorney Nico DeLaGuardia and stated at one point that he believed some of the evidence against Savage, a former political rival of DeLaGuardia's, was manufactured by the prosecution. Both papers play it the same way. Nico takes it in the chops. A made-up case against a past political opponent. Ugly stuff. It will run coast to coast. My friend Nico will be doing the hurt dance for a long time to come. The press, blind as ever to halftones or grays, makes no mention of Nico's final gesture of decency in dismissing the case. I go down to the river. The city is strangely quiet tonight. A new place with outdoor tables on the riverbank is open, and I have 2 beers and a sandwich. I hold the sports page up before me, a way to avoid responding to the lingering gazes of occasional passers-by, but for the most part I am engaged in a kind of numb reflection. I call Barbara near 6, but there is no answer. I hope she is on the way to the airport. I want to get home to see Nat. But before that, there is one stop I have to make. The front door is open when I return to Stern's office, but the suite is almost deserted. I hear only one voice, which I know just by its word-blank rumble to be Stern's. I follow the sound to Sandy's rich office. From what I hear in the hallway, I take it that he is discussing another lawsuit. The lawyer's life, I think, as I catch sight of him there. This morning, Sandy Stern won the best-known case of his career. Tonight, he is working. There is a brief open before him while he talks on the phone. Copies of the afternoon editions of both papers have been tossed aside onto the sofa.
"Ah, yes," he says. "Rusty has just come in now. Yes. No later than 10 tomorrow morning, I promise."
He replaces the receiver.
"A client," he says. "So, I see you returned."
"I'm sorry I ran out." Sandy raises a hand. No explanation is needed. "But I wanted to see you," I tell him.
"That happens," says Stern. "I have clients after trials such as this, Very intense experiences who are coming back for days, weeks, really. It is very difficult to believe it is over.
That's sort of what I'd like to talk about, I say. May I?
I take one of Sandy's cigars, which he has often offered. He joins me and selects one as I hold his humidor. We smoke, lawyer and client.
I wanted to thank you.
Sandy raises his hand the same way he did before. I tell him how much I admired his defense of me, how seldom I was inclined to second-guess. You are, I say, the very best. This praise appears to run over Sandy with the soothing effect of a bath of warm milk. With this last compliment, he does little more than laugh and tip his cigar, one of his courtly gestures, helpless before the truth.
I also have been thinking about things, and I'd like to know what happened in that courtroom today.
Today? Asks Sandy.
Today you were acquitted of serious charges.
No, no, I say. I want to know what really happened.
Yesterday you explained to me why Laren would have to let the case go to the jury, and today he acquitted me without so much as a motion from the defense.
Rusty, I made an estimate of what the judge might think.
What lawyer do you know who possesses the ability to always correctly predict judicial inclinations?
Judge Little decided not to expose you to the risk of an unsupported jury verdict, which might have increased the pressure on him away from what he thought was right. We should both be grateful to him for his perspicacity and his fortitude.
Last night your estimate was that the state's case was good enough to go to jury.
Rusty, I am, by nature, pessimistic.
Certainly you cannot take me to task for my discipline. If I had predicted victory and the result were otherwise, I could understand your concern.
This I do not.
Don't you?
We both know that the prosecution's case was not strong to start, and that it weakened as it progressed. Some rulings were favorable, some witnesses balked, some cross-examinations succeeded. One piece of evidence was unaccounted for. Another was clearly mischaracterized. The state case failed. We have each seen that happen before on many occasions. And matters went from bad to worse for them today. Consider Dr. Robinson's testimony this morning. That was very telling.
You really think so? I didn't tell him I killed Carolyn. So what? I'm a lawyer, a prosecutor. I know better than to confess to anyone.
But to visit a psychiatrist 2 days after the murder, to have the advantage of this most intimate of professional relationships, and to make no culpable statement of any kind? Rusty, this was significant proof, elicited by the prosecution, no less. Perhaps if I had known of it, I would have not made the prediction which I did last night.
Sandy frowned somewhat. His eyes are slightly averted.
At a moment like this, Rusty, of such sudden change, I have seen persons react strangely. You should not allow your thoughts about events themselves to cloud your appraisal of matters.
Very diplomatic. Don't let the fact that you killed her influence your judgment as a lawyer. This mild betrayal of me, subtle though it is so much out of character that I am now certain I am right. I've been in these courtrooms a dozen years now, Sandy. Something is wrong.
Stern smiles. He puts down his cigar. He clasps his hands.
There is nothing wrong here.
You are acquitted.
The system so operates. Go home to your wife. Is Nathaniel back yet? That should be a marvelous reunion for all of you.
I refuse to be distracted.
Sandy, what accounts for what happened today?
The evidence. Your lawyer. The lawyers on the other side. Your own good character, which was well known to the judge.
Rusty, what else is it that you think I can tell you?
I think you know what I know, I tell him.
Which, Rusty, is what?
about the B-file, about Laren and Carolyn, about the fact that she used to carry money to him. Shock, acute surprise, is not in Sandy Stern's emotional range. His faith in his own worldliness is such that he would never allow anything to so affect him. But his expression now gathers intensity. His mouth draws. He turns his cigar toward him and considers the ash before he looks back at me.
Rusty, with all respect, you have been through a great deal. I am your friend, but I am also your lawyer.
Lawyer.
I keep your secrets, but I do not tell you mine.
I can handle the facts, Sandy. I assure you I can. I've dealt with a lot the last few months, and as you told me last night, I'm very good at keeping a secret. I just have this bizarre commitment to learning the truth. I'd like my sense of irony complete. I wait, and Stern at last gets to his feet.
I see the problem. You worry about the judge's integrity.
With cause, wouldn't you say?
No, I would not agree.
Stern perches on the sofa arm, a white, nubby fabric. He takes a moment to loosen his tie.
Rusty, what I say to you, I know. How I know is not a concern for you. I have had many clients. Persons worry. They seek a lawyer's advice at times. That is all. And we speak now tonight, and these things are never spoken again by either of us. For my part, I tell you now, I have never said any of these things. Understood?
Very well.
You doubt Laren's character. You must forgive me, Rusty, a moment of philosophy, but not all human misbehavior is the result of gross defects of character. Circumstances matter, too. Temptation, if you will allow an old-fashioned word. I have known Laren throughout my career, and I tell you that he was not himself. His divorce left him in a state of disorder. He was drinking much too heavily. I understood he was gambling. He had fallen into this relationship with a beautiful and self-seeking woman, and his professional life was shattered. He had given up his practice when it was at its zenith, both in terms of his prominence and its financial rewards. I am sure he meant by this change to make up for the reversals in his personal life, and instead he found himself confined as an act of political vengeance in a judicial dumping zone, adjudicating matters of picayune importance which had no relation to what had attracted him to the bench at the outset. Laren is a powerful mind, able, and he heard for years about nothing but traffic tickets, tavern brawls, sexual interludes in the forest, matters at the periphery of public justice. All of these cases end the same way, with the defendant discharged. It is only a question of labels. Case dismissed, pre-trial supervision, post-trial probation. The defendant, in any event, returns home, and Laren was in an environment whose thoroughgoing corruption was always one of this city's most distressing secrets. The bondsmen, the policemen, the probation officers, the lawyers, the North Branch was a beehive of illicit dealing. Do you think, Rusty, that Laren Little was the first judge in the North Branch courthouse to fall by the wayside? You can't be apologizing for him, I say. And Stern's look becomes fomented, severe. Not for a moment, he says strongly. Not for a moment. I do not for a moment condone what we speak of. It is a disgrace. Our public institutions crumble from such conduct. If such matters had been the object of proper accusation and proof, and were I the judge before whom they were tried, the prison sentences would be lengthy, probably lifelong, whatever my affinities or affections. But what happened, happened in the past, long in the past. Judge Little, I tell you, would rather die, I mean this sincerely, die rather than corrupt his office in the Superior Court. This judgment is heartfelt and not merely a lawyer's sanctimony about a judge.
My experience as a prosecutor, Sandy, was that people aren't usually just a little corrupt. It's a progressive disease.
This is an episode in the past, Rusty.
You're confident it's over?
Very.
Is that another story, too? How it ended?
Rusty, you must understand that I do not have a historian's knowledge. I heard personalized accounts from certain individuals.
How did it end, Sandy? He looks down at me from the vantage of the sofa arm. His hands are on his knees. His face is without humor. Confidences are the core of Sandy Stern's professional life. To him, these are intimate and sacred matters.
My understanding, he says finally, is that Raymond Horgan became knowledgeable of what was occurring and demanded that it cease. Some police in the 32nd District began to assemble evidence. Other persons with knowledge of that had deep fears that any probing of corruption in the North Branch would ultimately prove the undoing of many persons besides Judge Little. It was frankly from one or two of these concerned persons that I heard this account. At any rate, they determined that the PA should be properly advised of an ensuing investigation.
Stern looks off for a moment.
Perhaps, he says with the most remote of smiles, that was their lawyer's advice. Privately, I'm sure it was calculated that Horgan would naturally inform his old friend of the perils to which he was exposed and counsel him at all costs to stop. I believe that is what occurred. I emphasize that I do not know whether or not I am correct. As you no doubt perceive, I am most uncomfortable with this kind of conversation, and I have never made any effort to confirm this information.
I should have figured that Horgan was in the middle of this somehow.
I take a minute. What is this feeling? Something between disappointment and derision.
You know, I say, there was a time when I thought Raymond Horgan and Laron Little were heroes.
With justification. They did many heroic things, Rusty. Many.
And what about Molto? Did you ever hear anything about him?
Stern shakes his head no. He was unsuspecting, as far as I know. It is difficult to believe that was really the case. Perhaps he was exposed to other suspicions and refused to believe them. It is my understanding that he himself was somewhat in Carolyn's thrall. A lapdog, a devotee. I am sure she was able to manipulate him. In Latin America, one sees, or saw when I was a young man, I have no idea of what transpires now, but when I was young, I frequently met women of Carolyn's type, women who used their sensuality with what we might call an aggressive twist. In this day and age, there is something more troubling about a woman with such an old-fashioned and oblique approach to the avenues of power. It seems more sinister. But she was very skillful.
She was a lot of things, I say. Oh, Carolyn, I suddenly think with unbearable sadness. What was it that I wanted with you, Carolyn? Something in the moment makes me think that Stern has not quite got her right. Perhaps it is the past ordeal and its extraordinary end today. Maybe it's amnesty week in Kendall County. No one may be blamed. Perhaps it is only one more of the same debased obsession. Yet, for whatever reason, even after all of it, as I sit here amid the cigar smoke and soft furniture, I still feel for her. And feel most of all, now, sympathy. It is possible that I misjudged Carolyn entirely. Perhaps she suffered from some birth defect, like a newborn come into the world with certain organs missing. Perhaps the feeling parts were absent in her, or subject to some congenital atrophy. But I do not believe that.
She was, I think, like so many of the hurt and maimed who have passed before me. The synapses and receptors were in working order on her heart and feelings, but they were overloaded by the need to give solace to herself. Her pain. Her pain. She was like a spider caught in her own web. In the end, in her own monumental way, she must have been in torment. Surely that was no accident. I can only guess about the causes. What forge of cruelty produced her, I do not know. But there was some form of abuse, some long-practiced meanness, from which she clearly meant to escape. She sought to recreate herself. She took on every lustrous role, a moll, a star, a person of causes, a conquistadora of wayward passion, a clever, hard-nosed prosecutrix, determined to master and punish those lesser types who could not contain ugly and violent impulse. But no disguise could change her. The heredity of abuse is so often more abuse. Whatever cruelty made her, she took in, and with self-delusion, wild excuses, but always, I would think, some straining residuum of pain, turned it back out into the world. "And so," asks Stern, "are you better satisfied?" "About Laren?" "What else?" He has apparently misinterpreted my moment of reflection. "I'm hardly satisfied, Sandy. He had no business presiding over this case. He should have excused himself the minute it was assigned to him." "Perhaps that is so, Rusty. But let me remind you that Judge Little had no idea when this case began that that file, the B file, as you call it, was going to be an element of your defense."
"You did."
"Me?" Stern waves at some of the smoke and passes a remark in Spanish that I do not understand. "Am I, too, the target of complaint? Certainly you do not think that I plan to focus on that file at the threshold. And even then, Rusty, was I to make a motion for Judge Little to excuse himself? How would you have framed it? The defendant asks the court to recuse itself because the alleged victim was once Your Honor's lover and partner in crime?"
"Some matters are not for courtroom pleading, really, Rusty. I do not mean to appear the cynic, and I share your concern for professional standards, but I suggest again that you are reacting to the shock of events. This punctiliousness under the circumstances is a bit surprising."
"I don't mean to be a prig. If I am, I apologize, but I'm not concerned about form or technicalities. I have the feeling things were bent well out of shape." Stern draws back, removing his cigar. It is a long, slow motion meant to show surprise. But it is no longer opening night. I have seen all of Sandy Stern's best moves a number of times, and I don't buy this one. "Sandy, I've been thinking hard about things in the last few hours. Laren Little's career was over if the circumstances of the B-file were fully explored, and you used every opportunity to tell him that you intended to do just that."
"Really, Rusty, you must know things that I do not. I saw nothing to indicate that Judge Little fully understood the import of that file. You must remember that its contents were never even in the courtroom."
"Sandy, would you be offended if I told you that I still don't think you're sharing everything with me?"
"Ah," says Stern. "We have been too long together on this case. You begin, Rusty, to sound something like Clara." He smiles, but I again refuse to be dissuaded.
"Sandy, it took a long time for this to sink in. I admit that. For a while, I thought that it was just a bizarre coincidence. You know, I thought it was just lucky that your harping on that file took advantage of Laren's vulnerability. But I realize now that's not possible. You meant to catch the judge's attention. There was no other reason for you to keep referring to that file. The last time you did it, when Lip was on the stand,
We were way past the point where you needed to raise doubts about Tommy. By then you knew all about Kumagai. You knew you were going to blow Molto away with that. But you went out of your way again to tell the judge we were going to offer proof about the file the first chance we got. You must have told him that one way or the other half a dozen times. You wanted Laren to believe that we were hell-bent on turning that file inside out in public. That's why you mentioned that whole business of a frame-up while Horgan was on cross. You wanted to create a record in which Laren would think he had no proper way to keep you from going ahead. And yet when you sat down with me to talk about a defense, you didn't mention word one about the file. We had nothing to offer.
Stern is silent. You're a fine investigator, Rusty, he says at last.
And you're very flattering. Actually, I've had the feeling lately that I was fairly dull. There are still a lot of things I haven't figured out. Like what you mentioned a second ago. How did you know that Laren would realize that the B file concerned a case where he'd been dirty? What else is there to the story?
Stern and I stare at each other for a moment. His look is deeper and more complex than ever. If he is disconcerted, it is well concealed. There is no more to tell, Rusty, he says at last. I made certain assumptions, particularly when I saw the judge's reactions with Horgan on the witness stand. They are very close, of course, and as I say, it is my understanding that Raymond would have been quite sensitive to the implications of that file. It seemed likely to me that he and Laren must have communicated about it sometime in the past. But I have no special knowledge, just a lawyer's intuition.
Horgan. That was what I missed. Raymond had to have told Laren about that file long ago. Stern is correct. For a moment I spin out the further calculations that follow. But that is not for now. I want to clear the books first with Stern.
So let me see if I get it, I tell him.
You wouldn't dream of directly threatening the judge with exposure. That could be counterproductive, even disastrous. And it's simply not Stern's style. You had to find your own perfect and subtle way of doing things. You wanted Laren to worry about the file, but to believe that he alone perceived his problem. And so, at all moments, you made it appear that the defense was in pursuit of Tommy Molto. You acted as if you thought he was the bad guy the file would expose. And the judge bought it.
He did his best to steer us in the wrong direction. He did everything he could to make Tommy's zeal look sinister.
Laren derided Molto's character. He held him in contempt, accused him of manufacturing evidence, of signaling witnesses. But that was a double edge. The worse Tommy looked, the stronger your argument for going into the B-file became, because it began to seem like this really was a frame-up, engineered by Molto to keep Savage from discovering Tommy's twisted past. And so it was more and more important for Laren to end the trial. He could never take the chance of letting you go into that file, as you kept saying you wanted to do.
Laren didn't know what would come out. But the worst thing, of course, was the truth.
He could bet the ranch that whatever Tommy knew about the bad old past in the North Branch, he wouldn't keep it to himself. Molto might hold back to protect Carolyn and her memory, but not to save Laren's ass at the cost of his own. And so, without so much as a motion from us, Judge Little declares a TKO and sends me home. And Sandy, there was one man in the courtroom who knew that was what had to happen.
You figured it was coming all along.
Stern's eyes are large and clear and somberly brown.
Do you judge me so harshly, Rusty?
No. I share the stern outlook. No one is above temptation. Sandy smiles at that, somewhat sadly.
Just so, he tells me.
But tolerance doesn't require an absence of standards. I know I sound like a world-class ingrate, but I have to tell you, I don't approve.
I did not act for my own benefit, Rusty.
He looks at me in that familiar way, lowering his chin so he can observe me from beneath his drawn brow.
It was a situation in which we, found ourselves. I did not create it. My own recollection of some of the matters you refer to was refreshed as we proceeded. I dwelt on Molto initially because he was so much easier a target than Delaguardia. It was necessary to develop this theme of past rivalries, somehow. When certain other matters came to mind, it was convenient to continue in the fashion that you have described, but I did not mean to coerce the judge. It was for that reason that I made Molto our straw culprit, so that Judge Little would not feel impelled to do something rash. Was I aware that this might create certain subterranean pressures on Laren as well? Stern gestures. He nearly smiles. Again there is that mysterious Latin look, used this time as the most reluctant, if philosophical, form of acquiescence. As you put it, I assessed a point of vulnerability. But I think, overall, in your analysis, you credit me with an intricacy of mind that no human being, certainly not I, possesses. I made certain judgments instantaneously. This was not a charted course. It remained a matter of intuition and estimation throughout. I'll always wonder, you know, about the outcome. That would be inappropriate, Rusty. I understand your concern now, but I would hesitate before I accepted your view of the judge's ultimate ruling. His handling of this case was, I believe, even-handed on the whole. Certainly, if he was seeking a convenient way to terminate the proceedings, he could have prohibited the prosecution from offering their fingerprint testimony in the absence of the glass. Even Delaguardia, disappointed as he was, conceded that Laren's decision today was within the realm of the judge's legitimate discretion. Do you think Nico would have made that handsome gesture of dismissing the case if he believed Laren's assessment was unfounded? Judge Little entered a proper decision, and had he not, I am confident you would have been acquitted. Isn't that what the jurors told the press? That is indeed what the papers reported. Three jurors told the media on the courthouse steps that they would not have voted to convict. But Sandy and I both know that the seat-of-the-pants impressions of three laymen who have learned that the judge on the case called it a loser are worth very little, and are hardly determinative of what nine other people would have done in any event. Stern continues, "As I say, I made judgments. If, in retrospect, either one of us regards them as questionable, then that should be a burden on my conscience, not yours. Your role is to accept your good fortune on its face, without further reflection. This is the legal significance of an acquittal. This matter is now entirely disposed of. I urge you to move forward. You will overcome this shadow on your career. You are a gifted lawyer, Rusty. I always regarded you as one of the finest of Horgan's prosecutors, probably the best. I was quite disappointed that Raymond did not have the sense to step aside last year and attempt to make the appropriate political arrangements so that you could have succeeded him." With that, I smile. Now I know that the worst is really over. I have not heard that old saw in many months. "I believe you are going to be all right, Rusty. I sense that." For my part, I sense that Stern is about to say something regrettable, even perhaps that I have profited from this experience. I spare him the chance. I pick up my briefcase, which had been left here. Stern sees me to the door. We stand at the threshold shaking hands, promising to speak, knowing that, whatever else, in the future, we will have very little to say to one another. Fall. Chapter 37. Only the poets can truly write of liberty, that sweet, exhilarant thing. In my life, I have not known an ecstasy as dulcet or complete as the occasional instance of shivering delight when I again realize this peril is behind me, over, done.
Whatever the collateral consequences, whatever the smirking, the unvoiced accusations, the contumely or scorn with which others might treat me, to my face, or more certainly behind my back, whatever they say, the terror is over. The sleepless, early morning hours I spent trying to catapult myself ahead in time, envisioning a life of mindless toil during the day, and nights working like half the other inmates on my endless train of habeas corpus petitions, and, finally, the wary, fearful hours of half-sleep on some prison bunk, awaiting whatever perverse terror the night would bring. That horror is past me, and with a sense of earned relief. Every sin of my life seems truly expiated. My society has judged. No punishment is due. Every sticky cliché is right. An enormous weight has been lifted. I feel as if I could fly, like a million bucks, 10 feet tall. I feel free. And then, of course, the shadow moves, and I think what I have been through, with enormous anger and bitterness and a swooping descent into depression. As a prosecutor, I lost cases, more naturally than I would have liked, and had my chance to observe the acquitted defendant in the instant of victory. Most wept. The guiltier they were, the harder they cried. I always thought it was relief and guilt. But it is, I tell you, this disbelief that this ordeal, this, think of the word, trial, has been endured for no apparent point but your disgrace and your uncompensable damage. The return to life is slow, an island on which a soft wind moves. The first 2 days, the phone does not stop. How people who did not speak to me for the past 4 months can imagine that I could accept their glib congratulations astounds me. But they call, and I am calculating enough to know they may be needed again. I accept their good wishes with some aplomb, but I spend most of my time alone. I am overwhelmed by the desire to be out in the waning summer and the stirring fall. One day I hold Nat out of school and we go fishing from a canoe. The day passes and we say almost nothing, but I am content to be with my boy, and I feel he knows it. Other days I walk in the forest for hours. Very slowly I begin to see things and therefore notice what I did not see before. My life for 4 months has been an oblivion, a hopeless storm of feeling so wild that there was nothing outside it. Every face that presented itself to my imagination did so with cyclonic impact in my interior reaches, which now, gradually, are growing still, and which, I finally realize, will in time again require movement. For the present, I remain at home. My neighbors say that I should write a book, but I am not ready yet for any enterprise. It becomes clear quickly that Barbara finds my presence disconcerting. Her irritation with me, held so long in check, now returns in a peculiar fashion. She clearly feels unable to speak her mind. There are no overt complaints, no instance of shrill sarcasm. As a result, she seems even more confined within herself than ever. I find her staring at me with an intense look, troubled, angry, I think. What? I ask. Her chin dimples in disapproval. She sighs. She turns away. Are you ever going back to work? She asks me one day. I can't get anything done with you around here. I'm not bothering you. You're a distraction. By sitting in the living room? By working in the garden? I admit that I'm trying to provoke her. She lifts her eyes to heaven. She walks away. Now she never rises to the bait. This battle, such as it is, must be fought in silence. It is true that I have made no effort to secure employment. The checks continue to arrive every 2 weeks from the PA's office. Delaguardia, of course, has no justifiable cause to fire me, and it would turn the office on its head were I to return to work. Nico is under siege from the press. The national reports have increased the sense of local embarrassment. What might ordinarily have passed as mere incompetence in the administration of county affairs has been magnified into a major scandal through the lens of coast-to-coast attention. Nico Della Guardia has made us in Kendall County look to the world like benighted backwoods buffoons. The editorial writers, and even the few local politicians of the opposing political party, demand that Nico appoint a special prosecutor to investigate Tommy Molto. The local bar association has opened an inquiry to determine whether Tommy should be disbarred. The common belief is that Nico, in his ambition to vault himself into the mayor's office, pressed too hard, and that in response Molto manufactured evidence in league with painless Kumagai. Nico's dismissal of the case is widely read as a confession. Only on occasion are other motivations suggested. I saw a Sunday piece by Stu Dubinsky which mentioned the B-file and the aroma that surrounded the North Branch Courthouse during those years, but nothing ever followed. Whatever the general understanding, I am not inclined to correct it. I will not exculpate Nico or Tommy or Painless. I still have no wish to tell what I know, that it was my seed taken from Carolyn, that those surely were my prints found on that glass in the apartment, that the carpet fibers detected were from my home, that all the calls the records showed were made from my phone. I will never be ready to brook the costs of these admissions, and there is a rough justice in this. Let Tommy Molto enjoy the experience of attempting to disprove what circumstance seemingly makes obvious. I accept the checks. It is Mac's last act as chief administrative deputy in the PA's office, before taking the bench, to negotiate a date at which my stipend may end. Nico has suggested 6 more months. I demand an additional year as reparations. 9 months is ultimately agreed. In our final conversation on this subject, Mac honors our friendship mightily by asking me to speak at her induction. This is my first public outing. Ed Mumphrey, who presides in the ceremonial courtroom, introduces me as a man who knows a great deal about justice. And the 300 or 400 persons who have assembled to watch Mac become a judge rise to their feet to applaud me. I am now a local hero. Kendall County's Dreyfus. People regret some of the pleasure that they felt watching me be flogged. Yet it is not possible for me to forget how out of place I feel in society. The trial is still like a shell around me. I cannot reach out. Because I am one of the 3 speakers at the ceremony, Nico is not present. But Horgan could not appropriately stay away. I attempt to avoid him. But later, amid the jostling by the hors d'oeuvres tables at the hotel reception, I feel a hand upon my arm. Raymond has that blarney smile. He does not take the risk of offering his hand. "How have you been?" he asks in a hearty way. "I'm fine." "We should have lunch." "Raymond, I'll never do another thing in my life that you tell me I should." I turn, but he follows me. "I put that badly. I would really appreciate it, Rusty, if you would have lunch with me. Please." Old affections, old connections. So hard to break. For what else do we have? I give him a date and walk away. I meet Raymond at his law firm, and he suggests that if I don't mind, we will not go out. Both of us would be better off without some clever item in the Eye on the Town column about how Raymond H. and acquitted Chief Depp buried the hatchet in Satinay's prime rib. Instead, Raymond has arranged a catered lunch. We eat shrimp remoulade alone in an enormous conference room on that stone table that seems to be composed of a single quarried piece, a 30-foot slab, polished and posted here as an auction block for the captains of industry. Raymond asks the obligatory questions about Barbara and Nat, and he talks about the law firm. He asks about me. "I won't be the same," I say. "I imagine.
I doubt you can. Are you waiting for me to say I'm sorry?
You don't have to be sorry. Doesn't do a damn thing for me, anyway.
So you don't want me to tell you I'm sorry?
I'm done giving you advice, Raymond, on how to behave.
Because I am. You should be.
Raymond does not miss a bite. He was prepared for some rancor.
You know why I'm sorry? Because Nico and Tommy made me believe it. It never dawned on me that they had fucked around with the evidence. I figured they'd do as they were taught. They're going to recall him, you know. Delaguardia, they're going to try. There are petitions circulating right now.
I nod. I have read as much. Nico announced last week that there were no grounds for the appointment of a special prosecutor. He expressed his confidence in Molto. And the papers and the TV editorialists pilloried him again. A state legislator made a speech on the floor of the House. This week's word is cover-up.
You know what Nico's problem is, don't you? Bolcaro. Bolcaro won't give him the time of day anymore. Augie's going to sit on his hands on this recall, too. Nico will have to make it on his own. Bolcaro feels like he gave Nico a boost, and the next thing he knows, Delaguardia is a candidate for mayor. Sound familiar?
I say, mm-hmm. I want to sound bored. I want to sound petulant. I came here to make my anger plain. I have promised myself that I will not be concerned about how low I sink. If I feel like calling names, I will do it. Throwing punches, tossing food, there will be no point below which I will not descend.
Look, he says suddenly, put yourself in my shoes. This was a hard thing for everybody.
Raymond, I say, what in the fuck did you do to me? I ate your shit for 12 years.
I know. You were out to axe me. I told you. Nico made me believe it. Once you believe it, I'm sort of a victim in the whole thing.
Go fuck yourself, I say. And when you're done fucking yourself, go fuck yourself again. I wipe the corners of my mouth with a linen napkin. But I make no move to leave. This is just the beginning. Raymond watches me, bitterness and consternation moving through his ruddy face. Finally, he clears his throat and tries to change the subject.
What are you going to do, Rusty, with your career?
I have no idea.
I want you to know I'll help however I can. If you like, I'll see what's available here. If there's anything else in town that interests you, just say so. Whatever I'm able to do, I will.
The only job outside the PA's office that ever sounded good to me was something you mentioned, being a judge. Think you can do that? Do you think you can give me back the life I had? I look at him levelly, intent on letting him know that this tear cannot be repaired. My tone is sardonic. No judicial candidate can carry the baggage of a murder indictment. But Raymond does not flinch.
All right, he says. Do you want me to explore that? See if I can find you a seat?
You're full of it, Raymond. You don't have that kind of clout anymore.
You may be wrong about that, my friend. Augie Bolcaro thinks I'm his best buddy now. Just as soon as he got me out of the way, he decided I could be useful. He calls me up with questions twice a week. I'm not kidding, either. He refers to me as an elder statesman. Isn't that something? If you'd like, I'll speak with him. I'll have Laren speak with him.
Don't do that, I tell him quickly. I don't want your help, and I don't want Laren's either.
What's wrong with Laren? I would figure you'd worship that guy. He's your friend, for one thing.
Horgan laughs.
Boy, you came up here with one idea in mind, didn't you? You just want to piss all over me.
Raymond pushes the plate aside.
You want to give me 12 years back talk in 5 minutes? Fine, go ahead and do it. But listen to me. I didn't set you up. You want to take a dump on somebody? Tommy deserves it. So does Nico, as far as I'm concerned. Join the crowd. If you want, I'm sure you can contact the Bar Association. They'll move you to head of the line and let you take a public crap all over both of them.
They already called. I told them I had nothing to say.
So why me, huh? I know you didn't like seeing me on the witness stand, but did I lie up there? I didn't say a goddamn thing that didn't happen, and you know that, brother.
You lied to me, Raymond.
When?
For the first time, he's surprised.
When you gave me the B-file. When you told me how Carolyn asked for it. When you told me that it was a bullshit allegation.
Oh, says Horgan, slowly. He takes a moment to adjust, but he does not falter. Raymond Horgan, as I always knew, is tough.
Okay, now I get it. Some little birdie has been whispering in your ear, huh?
Who was it? Lionel Keneally?
He was always your asshole, buddy. You know, there are a few things you might like to hear about him, too.
Nobody's a hero, Rusty. You got your nose bent out of shape about that?
Fine. I'm not a hero.
Some other people weren't heroes. That was nothing to do with you being charged with murder.
He points at me, still unflummoxed.
And how about my getting a fair trial, Raymond? Did you think about that? Did you know whether or not Laren was going to tool me because he wanted to keep that thing under wraps?
He's not that kind of guy. He's not that kind of guy?
We're talking about somebody who sold his robe. Come off it. The only thing he cared about, or you for that matter, was making sure nobody found out.
Let me ask you something, Raymond. How was it that my case got drawn to Laren? Who gave Ed Mumfrey the call?
Nobody gave Mumfrey any calls. Just dumb luck, huh?
So far as I know. Did you ever ask?
Laren and I didn't talk about your case, ever. Not once that I remember. I was a witness. And as strange as it may sound to you, we both behaved properly.
Look, he says, I know what you think, I know how it sounds, but Rusty, you're talking about bullshit. It's something that happened to the guy 9 years ago when he had his head stuck completely up his ass.
How did it happen, Raymond?
I ask, my curiosity for a moment greater than my anger.
Rusty, I don't know what the fuck went on. I talked to him about it exactly once, and the conversation didn't last any longer than it had to. He was drunk on his ass half the time in those days. You know, she was the PO. Guys on bond would give her their sob story. She started putting in a word with the judge, and he'd go along. I'm sure he thought it'd make her happier to lift her skirt. One day, one of these guys she's helped out gives her a C-note for her troubles. She brings it to Laren to figure out what to do. He thinks it's funny. She does, too. They go out and blow it on dinner. One thing leads to another. They had a high old time, I guess. He always thought it was like a fraternity prank. They both did.
And you hired her knowing this?
Rusty, that's how I hired her. Laren was giving me all this hearts and flower crap about how broke she was from paying off her law school tuition and making $11,000 a year as a PO. I said, fine, I'll double her salary, but knock this shit off. I thought I'd leave her out there as a deputy. Nobody ever liked those assignments. And with two other deputies to watch her, what could she do? And instead, it turns out she did a hell of a job. A hell of a job. She wasn't long on scruples, but the lady had a lot of brains. And I finally got Laren transferred downtown. And he performed with real distinction. I'll go to my grave believing that. No one will ever be able to knock Laren's integrity on his handling of a felony case. A year later, they were both so respectable they didn't even talk to one another. If she exchanged 10 words with Laren in the last 5, 6 years, I'd be amazed. And, you know, as time passed, it got to the point that I could see what he saw in her. You know what came of that.
This, of course, is the answer to what puzzled me last spring. Why did Carolyn make her move first for me, rather than Raymond, when she perceived the prospective vacuum at the head of the office? It was not my manliness, my dark good looks. I was fresher, nowhere near as wise. She probably figured Raymond would know better. He should have. Maybe he even did. Maybe that's why she didn't end up with what she wanted. Why Raymond gave no sign of having been pained. He saw her coming. He knew what to look for.
Well, isn't that nice, I say. Everything worked out. Until you get a certain piece of anonymous correspondence.
And so you gave her that file to Trunk?
No, sir, no way. I gave it to her. I didn't know what it was. I told her to look at it, and to bear in mind that she could never tell who might be looking over her shoulder. That's all I said. What do you want from me, Rusty? I'm seeing the gal by then. Am I supposed to pretend? If I was such a bum, I'd have done just what you said, headed for the shredder with the thing.
I shake my head. We both know he is much too careful for that. No way to tell who may come looking for the letter. That's the kind of job that a Medici like Raymond knows he should hand off, and with instructions that will never bounce back on him. Very artful. Investigate. See what's going on. And what goes unspoken is that if it has to do with Laren and you, clean the mess up very carefully. Carolyn certainly tried. I don't have to wonder anymore who had Leon's arrest file from the 32nd District.
And when she got cooled, you ran and collected the file?
When she got cooled, as you put it, I got a call from His Honor. You know, I had told him about the letter when the thing came in. So he's on the phone the day they find the body. Pure Laren, too. He's always been a sanctimonious asshole. He says to me, it might be politically sensitive. Why don't I collect that file?
Raymond laughs. Alone. I do not relax my severe expression.
Listen, Rusty, when you asked me, I gave you the thing. You had no choice, and you tried to mislead me anyway.
Look, he says. He's my friend.
And the key to Raymond's black support,